morning.
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Welcome to our CLE, free CLE. We love to do that for you guys, on the new local rules. The rules are going to be effective November 1st. That's next week. They are going to apply not only to cases filed on or after November 1st, but to the extent practical, they're going to apply to pending cases. And we'll try to point out some places where maybe that won't work and maybe where we expect that it will work, as we go on. Let me introduce two of our judges are in hearings and they're going to be joining us just as quick as they can. But for everybody's benefit that may be new or you just appear by phone or whatever, Trustee Chapter 13 Trustee and 12 Trustee Rebecca Garcia, Chapter 13 Trustee Scott Leeske, Sean McDermott, he's our Chief Deputy Clerk at the Bankruptcy Court. He's a fabulous guy to get to know. He's willing to help you if you have questions or problems with filing, with events, with CM, this kind of stuff. Sean is your guy. I'm Judge Kelly. This is Judge Ludwig. And Judges Hannon and Helfinger will be joining us shortly. We're going to go through, we've got an outline. It's also posted. We're going to be recording the seminar for folks to listen to later. So I'm going to mention for their benefit that the outline is posted on our website in the local rules portion of the website. So for those listening online, if you want to follow along, that outline is available for you. We're going to start out with a discussion of why did we, you know, our local rules really weren't, it wasn't that long ago that Jeff Nordholm and Judge McGarity and a big group of hardworking people revised the local rules. Well, there's new national rules coming December 1st. These are significant changes, especially in the Chapter 13 area, but there's some other areas as well. So we thought it would be a good opportunity to take a look at all our rules and make sure that they are compatible with the national rules and code. So that's what was the impetus. On the first page of the outline, I've summarized for you the national rules that are changing. And I think maybe the biggest one is that you're going to be able to use a Chapter 13 plan to do a lien strip. We have always required an adversary proceeding to do a lien strip. This is stripping off that second mortgage that has no equity to glom onto. We've always required an adversary proceeding for that. Now you're going to be able to use a Chapter 13 plan to do that. The tricky part is, and you'll have to keep this in mind, if you're going to use that method, you need to serve your plan the same way as you served the adversary proceeding. So if your second mortgage that you're trying to strip is held by a federally insured bank, you need to use certified mail to serve that plan. So that's going to be a tricky one. The court's going to serve your plan for you if you file it with the petition. We'll use that bankruptcy noticing service to serve it, but we won't be serving it. They don't serve by certified mail. So if you want to take advantage, and by all means, please do. I mean, who needs the whole nightmare of the complaint and the summons and blah, blah, blah. By all means, take advantage of this new provision. You're going to have to serve by certified mail. So that's a biggie. Government-secured claims are dealt with differently. So if you're trying to strip off the city of Milwaukee, you got to take a look at that. There's new claims deadlines. Especially, they apply to all the chapters, they apply to 7, 12, and 13, but really 7s, if it's a no asset, of course, there's no claims, bar 8. But in 13, we've got these new, faster claims deadlines. They're in amended Rule 3002C. And that the notice of bankruptcy, these are all effective, by the way, December 1. So December 1, if you file a case, you're going to see the notice of commencement of case is going to have these new claims bar date deadlines in the Chapter 13. There's 70 days after the order for relief, the petition, 70 days, 7-0, to file that proof of claim. Now, Jay Pittner's over there going, oh my gosh, how can my mortgage servicer clients possibly get something done that quickly. Well, they get the residential mortgages in the 13s get an extra, I think it's 50 days, to supplement their claims with their documents. They have to file a claim, but then they get a little more time to get the required documents in. But take note, you've got to file a claim to participate now, and the deadlines are faster than they used to be. Local rule, new national rule 3015-1 is again a major change, where a national plan form was developed, it was studied, it was argued about, discussed, negotiated, and effective December 1, courts either have to use the national plan form or they have to develop a local plan form and require a local plan form which has certain provisions. We decided, after looking at it, not to use the national plan form and to develop our own local plan form. We're not going to really focus on our local plan form today. We're going to try to go through the rules, the annual update, which is November
15th and 16th.
Right, is going to really focus on that local plan form. So please sign up or go on the video, you know, get it by video, whatever. We're going to really try to focus on things other than the plan form, although a lot of this stuff, you know, kind of is. Yeah.
And I'll point out, we're having these national rules that Judge Kelly's going over quickly today. We have an hour on those national rules, and we have an hour for the plan. So we're going to go over these rules that Judge Kelly's, the national rules that go in effect December 1st, in more detail at the annual update.
Right. So the only other one I want to mention on the national rules is this. Negative notice is now available for claim objections. It's Rule 3007, and we had started to do that, I don't know, a year or so ago, where we, rather than requiring a hearing every time on a claim objection, you can file a claim objection as long as you support it with evidence. You might not need to have a hearing. Note that they are now specifying in the rule who to serve your claim objection on. It's the person and the address most recently designated on the proof of claim as the person to receive notices. So there was a debate about whether you have to use 7004 and go to the attention of an officer, managing director, blah, 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 blah. There was a case out of Madison where Judge Martin had ruled that way. You know, we looked at it, whatever. It's now in the national rule. You just have to serve on the person who's designated. Now, for U.S. government insured depository institutions, again, serve your claim objection per Rule 7004. That means certified mail for that bank, right?
For banks, for the government, it means you have to read the rule, but it's like the U.S. attorney if you're in your local district. So
right.
Read 7004 regarding government service on government claims.
So that's all I'm going to say about the new national rules. Just some highlights for you. They're listed there. There's going to be more info at the annual update. We're going to now turn to our rules, and Judge Helfinger is going to start us off with our new disclosure rules.
All right. When Congress amended Section 521 back in 2005, it said, among other things, that pay advices needed to be filed or other indicia of payment in the relevant period. And the court hadn't done that for a long time, in part because of privacy concerns and other things. But that is now being required, and there's a form.
Right. It's attached to your outline. He doesn't know this, but
payment looks like this. No one can see it, but trust me, it looks like this.
Right. Attached to the outline, payment advice cover sheet.
And the reason the cover sheet needs to be filed is because there'll be some debtors who won't have these, and you can't file what you don't have, right? And so this way, the court, meaning at the first line, the clerk's office, knows that, hey, this isn't, there's no 521 problem that anybody needs to worry about because somebody filed this and said, either here's the pay advices or the debtor doesn't have any pay advices, so don't worry about this. So that's that's sort of the reason for this form, is so that the court is aware, hey, okay, we don't need to worry about telling somebody that, you know, you have your 45 days to get those pay advices, well, really less, but your case will be automatically dismissed in 45 days if you don't get those files. So that's the importance of the form, is to allow us to know that, hey, this either they're filed or this is someone who doesn't have to file.
And note that it can be signed by the attorney for the debtor. It doesn't have to be signed by the debtor unless the debtor's pro se. And Sean, this form has been submitted to the Bankruptcy Software Preparation Services, so it should come out as part of your November 1st update. You'll start seeing this form in your software preparation. And is there a special event they use? Or
we've made a few CMECF modifications to accommodate it. There is an event that's a miscellaneous event, so the same menu that you go to file any of your schedules individually. So if you don't file the local form 1007 with your petition, you can use that miscellaneous event. You're also going to see another deadline set in the deficiency deadlines if you don't file it. And it will be included on that order for proposed dismissal. So we've added that deadline to accommodate all those forms.
And the thing I'll say from the Chapter 13 trustee perspective, you all know, anybody who does 13s regularly, that if you have an over-median debtor, we don't want 60 days of pay advices. We want the full 6 months. And I don't think anybody is going to care on the court side if you just attach the full 6 months to the... You have to do at least the 60 days. But so you're not doing it twice. We don't... Please, once you start filing with the court, don't also send it to me. It's duplicative. But just attach, if you want to attach the full 6 months, because you know that I'm going to ask for it anyway, just attach it to this form. Okay?
All right. So moving quickly through some of this, because time is short. Local Rule 1007.1 now requires disclosure of loan payments and transfers by a non-debtor spouse. 1007.2. Breaks disclosures into chapter-specific provisions. Mine is printed kind of oddly, but and you can see what those are. I don't know if you guys want to comment specifically about the Chapter 13 disclosures.
Not really. It's what we usually get. The 2 years of federal and state tax returns or transcripts. Obviously, we need the DSO information to do our notice, and then if you have a marital agreement, we always want to see that as well. So,
and I don't recall that it's been a while since we had these discussions, but I don't recall that the Chapter 7 disclosures are different so much as it may be a sort of reordering of where things are in the rules. So, in any event, moving to Local Rule 1009. Provides that the debtor must serve notice of commencement of the case and a copy of any 11, 12, or 13 plan and any new creditor that's added by an amendment and file proof of service so that, one, the creditor gets a copy, and two, so that the court knows that the creditors have been served. So pay particular attention to that. Local Rule 4004, this is... new. There are going to be disclosures. Some of these disclosures were always filed. Some of these disclosures were given to the Chapter 13 trustees, and some of it is new. And the disclosures I'm talking about are the disclosures at the time of discharge, so that the court can know that the provisions of the various discharge sections are complied with before granting the discharge. So in Chapter 7 case, there's still a need to make sure that there's compliance with 522Q, which I'm not going to explain 522Q, but there's a local form rule, form 2829, which apparently is attached to your materials, that explains that. And there's a 7-day deadline to file that.
That's your last page. You're hardly ever going to have it because it's going to be, your debtor's going to have to move from a place that has an exemption of over $160,000 and have not committed a felony. I have never in the 15 years or whatever since, or 10 years since BAPCPA, I've never seen this happen in this district. But in the event you have somebody who moves, and they might be covered by this, That's what it's for. Now there's a form you use to indicate that.
And to that point, this one, right, Chapter 7 disclosure form, unlike the disclosure forms I'll talk about in a minute in the other chapters, this one only gets filed if, in fact, there's a 522Q issue. And like Judge Kelly says, the chance of it actually having a 522Q problem is highly remote unless Wisconsin, you know, changes its laws. So more important, I think, are the disclosure forms for discharge in Chapter 13 and Chapter 12. They're very similar. There's a slight difference, and to the extent you have a Chapter 12 case, I'll focus on Chapter 13. If you have a Chapter 12 case, look at the disclosure form. There's a slight difference. Here, the disclosure form deals basically with three things: the domestic support obligation statement that the debtor is current on those. The 522Q issue, which we talked about. And finally, that, and this is the new and I think part to emphasize and be aware of, is the disclosure that the debtor has made all direct payments required by the plan. And that includes things like the maintenance payments in a Chapter 13 case on long-term debt. And this is the difference between 12 and 13. 1328 requires as a condition on the discharge that payments made to debt that is maintained under 1322B5, the debtor has made those direct payments under the plan. If you look at 1228 carves out from the discharge the what we'll call the maintenance payments under 1222 B5 and B9 maybe is the other one. And so that's the difference. But the important thing is in Chapter 13 case, the disclosure is going to say any direct payments, direct mortgage payments, there could be other direct payments, right, that the plan provides for, that those have all been made, because if you read 1228, that's a condition on the discharge. Anything else on that?
We have created two new events for these certifications, so they are also under the miscellaneous menu. Certifications for completion of Chapter 12 plan, certifications for completion of Chapter 13 plan. We are going to implement a deficiency reminder process for this. So once the completion of plan is filed, we will do an automated docketing function that will generate a notice to filers saying that these forms are required or their case would be closed without discharge. So similar to the reminder system we have in place for the financial management certificate, we'll have a similar process in place for this as well.
Right. So this will be triggered by the trustee filing a notice that all the plan payments due to the trustee have been made.
Right. So now what you see that gets filed is we file a form that has those check boxes on it. If you ever look, the form is much simplified. It just says that I as a trustee certify that all the payments due to me have been made, and then there's a little reminder for you and the debtor, who will get a mailed copy of that form from our office, that they need to they're not done yet. The thing to think about here is both Scott and my office does quite a bit of work at this point under what our current situation, under our current rules. We get the last payment, we send out a letter to you, we send a letter to the debtor, we say, we need your DSO and 522Q form. We're not going to do that anymore, okay? We get the last payment from the debtor, however it comes in, make sure everything is good in our system, and then within 30, our new local rule says within 30 days of receipt of that last payment, we send this notice of completion out. So that will start the clock running on you getting the rest of this back. So, you know, just it's something to pay attention to. You're not going to get a bunch of letters from the trustee's office leading up to the notice of plan completion being filed.
All right. So finally, there's an addition to handle instances where, especially in a joint case, where one of the debtors dies before discharge. This happens sadly more often, often enough that it made sense to have a rule on it. It comes up and people don't know quite how to handle it. The financial management course, I think everyone agrees, and now under this rule, I believe, basically the person is disabled from taking the management course, and therefore in a roundabout way you get to the conclusion doesn't have to do that. And so there is now a rule to look to if that happens, and you can follow what's in the rule, and I don't think you need to memorize it right now because you can go look at the rule when it comes up. So.
Great. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the next part, which is, I'm not sure that this is a big change from what we've been doing, but it's now sort of codified, if you will, on motions to continue or impose.
So if I can interrupt for one second. Yeah. As Judge Kelly says, this is motions to continue or extend the stay. And it's not really different, I don't think, than what we're doing. It's just that we changed the basic motion rule, and this is sort of down farther in the outline, to basically say almost everything is handled by negative notice. And this is one of those examples, and there's something in Chapter 11 and Chapter 12, where we have a different process. So this rule is basically to say, hey, you know, notwithstanding sort of the usual negative notice, this rule now says here's how you do this specific thing.
Right, and I that's a great point, because our old set of rules had I think it was Rule 9014, which said all of these kind of hearings, you must have a hearing. The court will have a hearing in all of these, and there was a list of about 8 or 9 of them. That rule is gone. That rule now says everything is negative notice except where otherwise, you know, the court says I want a hearing or otherwise provided in the rules. And this is an example where you need to get a hearing date from the court if you're going to file a motion to continue the automatic stay beyond the 30 days or a motion to impose the automatic stay where the debtors had 2 cases dismissed in the last year. And again, it's not different than what we do now, but it's all spelled out there very clearly, how much notice you need. We still continue to see people calling up like a week before the 30 days and going, oops, I just figured out that the debtor had a case dismissed in the last year. Can I quick have a hearing? Well, that's a big problem because the notice isn't very good that you're giving the creditors. I mean, if you find out right away and call up and say, give me a date, you're going to have your choice of dates probably, and we rarely have these hearings because mostly people don't object, and the debtor's able to give us an affidavit or declaration under penalty of perjury that shows that they're filing this case in good faith, so we don't have a hearing. But if you wait till it's too late to give effective notice, that's when the problems are created. So just a word on that, but I at least had been always having hearings for motions to impose the stay. That's where they've had the 2 cases. Now the new rule says I don't have to. If you call up, get your hearing notice, send it out, or your hearing date, send out your motion and your notice with your evidence that the debtors filed this 3rd case in good faith, and nobody objects, and I like the thing, we won't have to have a hearing. So I just had one yesterday, and I told Tim Hassel, hey, maybe next month if this happens again. He said, we don't have a lot of these, Judge. I said, okay, fine, great. So my point is, there's a rule now. This is one of the very few. You have to call the court. You're allowed to call the court and get your hearing date and get, you know, as soon as you possibly can after the case has been filed for a motion to continue the stay or a motion to impose a stay. Chapter 7 rules.
Good morning, everyone. My assignment this morning is to discuss the new Chapter 7 rules, which are, and actually one of these is not just Chapter 7, but a very limited topic. I think that's because part of my docket's the Western District, where we have 5 rules, not an entire 473 rules.
It's also why you got subsection 4.
4, okay. Yeah. Anyway, so Local Rule 2070. This is a revision of former Local Rule 2070.1. We had Local Rule 2070.1, but we didn't have Local Rule 2070. So that's one of the changes. We struck the point one. Otherwise, we simply increase the amount of expenditures that the Chapter 7 trustee can incur and pay without prior notice from $1,000 to $2,500. There's a listing of the specific expenses that can be paid pursuant to this provision. It's largely the same as the old version. There has been some cosmetic change to the and formatting change to the rule, but the primary difference is just keeping up with inflation and moving $1,000 to $2,500. The other new rule, which is a Chapter 7 rule, also applies to some of the other chapters, is Local Rule 7041, which is a new rule. And this relates to notice requirements for the dismissal of an adversary proceeding to deny or revoke discharge. It applies under 727, 1141, 1144, 1228, and 1328. And basically, in order to dismiss such an adversary proceeding, there must be a motion, and there are certain disclosures that are required, and there has to be 21 days notice. I'm not exactly sure what the impetus of this rule change is. It must be something that's come up. I have not had one of these come up, so.
You're not supposed to be able to buy a discharge.
Yeah.
If some creditor is objected to the debtor's discharge, other creditors might be sitting back saying, well, I'd really like to object to his discharge too, but I'm not going to spend the money. I'll let that other creditor spend the money. So if they just do a settlement, now this other creditor who might have gone forward
has noticed an opportunity.
Yeah, he can object and he can step in. That other creditor can step in. That is part of the national rules. We've just sort of put procedures in place to make our local rules comply with that. You're not supposed to settle these kind of objections without noticing and giving others the opportunity to step in and pursue that discharge.
Yeah, and part of the notice is there's a disclosure requirement that says this is what the consideration was.
Right.
So that's all.
Right.
There's transparency.
Right. So I'm going to go through the Chapter 11 rules pretty quickly because we really want to get to the meat and potatoes of our Chapter 13 changes. We had several Chapter 11 lawyers and U.S. trustee representatives. Thank you so much for participating and helping us get these rules modernized and something that I hope will make Chapter 11 practice, continue to go smoothly here. If you're going to have an amended Chapter 11 plan or an amended Chapter 11 disclosure statement, and this also applies to 12, by the way, the new rule requires, number 1010, requires you to file a red line copy to show people what the changes are that are being made. New local rule 4004 allows a case of a Chapter 11 individual debtor to be closed after confirmation of the plan and then reopened to grant the discharge. If the case remains open during the whole plan, that Chapter 11 debtor has to pay U.S. trustee fees on for the entire, it could be 5-10 years of the plan. So now this rule codifies again what you would need to do if you have a Chapter 11 debtor, you want to close the case administratively and then reopen it to get the discharge at the end. There were a lot of Chapter 11 rules in our former rules that have been eliminated. There were rules about sales, about prepackaged plans, and most importantly, I think, the rule about fee caps. And every application to employ an attorney for a debtor in possession in Chapter 11, the attorney had to say, this is what I think the fees are going to be for this case. And they would categorize them, and then, you know, that would just be part of it. And then as the case would go on, they would say, oh, increase the fee cap, I've spent more money, or whatever. All of that is gone. So you're welcome.
Yeah, that's an important point, right? Because people no doubt have forms out there on these things. And there are some things in the old rules that then no doubt people sensibly put in their forms, which is now no longer in the rules. And not longer in the rules just because we decided to get rid of some rules, but because if not all of us, at least some of us didn't like it. One thing that for example, wasn't there a requirement that 328 or be mentioned in
right,
the, that's quote, out, and that's out with purpose, right? I mean,
must quote section 328 in every application to employ a professional. No, not anymore. Please don't do that.
So take a look at those in your form. And
One more chapter 11 rule, and again, because this is another place in the rules where you must call in advance and get a hearing date from us. If you're a creditor, or you're the U.S. trustee or whatever, and you want to convert or dismiss a Chapter 11 case, there are strict requirements for the setting of hearing and the giving of notice. So the new local rule 9013.3 will require you to call up, get your hearing date, then send out your notice and your motion, etc. So motions to continue the stay, motions to convert or dismiss 11 are two places where you not only can call the court to get a hearing date in advance, you must call the court to get a hearing date in advance.
All right, new Chapter 13 rules.
Thank you. The first local rule, 1009, in the outline, Judge Haffinger briefly touched on that a little earlier. If you add a new creditor to the case, you need to make sure that you serve notice of the commencement of the case and any current plans on that debtor or on that creditor. You have to also file a proof of service indicating that you've done so, so the court's aware that that has been done. New local rule 2002.2, the deadline to object to the original plan has been changed to 28 days after the trustee concludes the meeting of creditors. And I just wanted to let everyone know that my office, probably not starting November 1, but shortly thereafter, within a few weeks, we are probably going to be changing the procedure at the meeting of creditors, where we are no longer adjourning the meeting of creditors to allow corrections and amended plans and things. We will adjourn meetings of creditors for things like proof of social security number or debtor not being able to be there for whatever reason. But instead of setting two adjournments out to fix everything, we're simply going to be filing an objection to confirmation of the plan. And hopefully that will move this confirmation process along much quicker and get issues resolved without having endless adjournments and things. So just be aware that within the next few weeks, that's probably coming down the line. Local rule 2014D, debtor does not need court approval to employ professionals, including real estate brokers. It's fairly self-evident. Local rule 2016.1, the no look fees have been changed effective November 1st, so don't file your plans yet asking for the additional fees, but those are going up to $4,500 for a standard case and $5,000 for a MMM case. There will also be a fee for cases that get dismissed pre-confirmation at a reduced amount of $1,000. I think we'll be going over those fees a little more in detail a little later.
Okay. I'm going to talk about the new Chapter 13 plan. As Judge Kelly indicated at the outset, we have the annual update when we in about a month on November 15th here in Milwaukee and 16th in Madison. We're going to talk about the new Chapter 13 plans just because I know we have a few Madison folks on the video as well. The Western District has a new plan as well. And in the Western District, they're going to talk about the Western District plan. So Mark Herring, the Chapter 13 trustee over there, is going to talk over there. And then we'll talk here. I'm going to be in Madison, so I'll be able to answer questions about our plan over there as well if anybody has them. But the use of the new form, local plan form, is mandatory. That is not a change, but we have a new form for the national model plan. It's on the court website, and like we said, we'll talk about it in detail, section by section, at the annual update. This one is important. If the debtor files the plan with the petition, the court will serve it. Otherwise, the debtor will serve it. So if your business practice or just your, for this particular debtor, you know, you're doing an emergency filing, and so you're just filing the bare bones petition, and you come back to, you know, within the 14 days, so on day 10 you file the plan and all the schedules, the bankruptcy noticing center is not going to serve that. You have to serve that. You have to put a notice of the service on the court docket. So the judges, I think, and certainly the trustees do not appreciate bare bones filings. So one of the, you know, in my opinion, one of the reasons for this rule is that we want you to file everything all together. So it is more work if you have to do it yourself. One of the new national rules actually says the debtor shall serve the plan. So you're actually, in some in this district, you're getting a bonus that the BNC is still going to serve that original plan if it's filed with
and,
the...
And, but again, if you're taking advantage of the new provision that you're going to put a lien strip in your plan, that's great, please do, that's wonderful, but you have to check out service, because even if the BNC has served your plan on everybody else, if you're trying to lien strip on somebody that's a national bank or insured bank, you have to use, get that plan served by certified mail and do a certificate of service to make it work.
And if you have, you know, think about it too, if it's, if you're, you know, doing, and I think this is true, and we've got this in the materials for the national, for the annual update, the cram down section, even if you're cramming down a car, I think the rules now are saying that that has to be served under 7004, but if it's not a bank, just make sure in the additional notice you've complied, because a lot of the 7004 service, if it's not a bank, is just first class mail. So the BNC will do that for you, just make sure it gets on the mailing matrix. So
we've made a lot of modifications to the Chapter 13 plan event. Because of the different special provisions in the model plan, we need to capture some of those things. So there'll be check boxes if you plan to strip a lien or some of the other things that you can now do in the plan. That accomplishes two things. One, it pulls the docket text, so it's visible to people looking at the docket. And two, we have to track that for statistical purposes. So you'll see some front-end changes to the plan event and the amended plan event that will include those provisions.
And it's my understanding, both myself and I know Sean has sent this to Best Case, and Sean, do you remember the name of the other software provider we had? There's one other that we know about, so if you don't use Best Case, please let us know right away. Send me an email, send Sean an email, so we can make them aware of these of the new forms if they're not already. But I don't know that Best Case, I assume they're going to have things ready by November 1st. I don't know that for sure. We don't have control over them. And I have not talked about this with the judges, so I might get disagreement here, but if you use the old plan on a case you file on November 1st, at this point, I think I'm going to be okay with that. If you use it on November 15th or December 1st, you are going to have to go back and redo it so it's the correct plan. I think that there's going to be some grace, but just, you know,
yeah,
make sure that you...
If the software providers don't have it,
we can't
control that.
Yeah.
We were trying to get ahead of this December 1st curve where the new rules come out and everybody's struggling, and so we were trying to get ahead of it. But if we are not trying to make it hard on people, we are not, we're not going to make you, you know, try to figure out how to fit your plan onto our PDF form or whatever. So we'll just play that by ear.
And it'll be the end of, you know, in case you file December 1st or November 1st, I am not going to see it at 341 till near the end of December. So there's going to be some time lag in there if you do want to change things. All right, back to the outline. So we talked about
So before we move past that, the point you were making, I think, though, that went by extremely fast, is yes, for non-financial, government-insured, non-financial institutions, mailing is good enough, but if it has to be 7004, it needs to be an officer or other identified person under 7004, which I think the point you were making, but it went by really fast. So a lot of times, if one looks at the matrix, right, one just has like a bunch of entities with no person on it. All of that, I think it's fair to say, would flunk 7004 service.
So if you're trying to mess with a particular secured creditor in your plan,
right?
Know what that means, right? Does anybody not understand what I mean by mess with?
Yeah. So you're cramming down Ford Motor Credit.
Cramming down Ford Motor Credit. Or shipping or...
Yeah. Ford Motor Credit is not a bank.
Or trying to say that the value of the car is only, and it's not a 910 car. So I'm going to say the car is only worth $1,000 and their claim is $5,000. If you're going to try to do that in your plan, and you're welcome to do that, then you have to make sure that you're serving that plan under 7004.
Yeah, so get the, you know, get the name, and you know, don't go Ford Motor Credit PO Box Detroit, Michigan, or whatever it is. You got to get the officer or agent in there, and that's what I meant when I said, you know, do it just under the additional notice, because you're going to want to serve the PO box so that the whoever you know, collections department at the PO box knows that you filed, but get that 7004 service right in there as well.
Yeah. And Judge Hannon's going to talk about the no-look fees and everything, but this is one of the reasons we raised them, because it is going to be harder. We think it is going to be a little bit harder and a little bit more work to comply with the rules and the new rules. So that is one of the reasons that that fee went up.
Yep. And now I'm going on to subsection F on page 4 of the outline. We have had here in the Eastern District the form called the notice of motion to, I think it was modified plan. Now there are two forms. And one of the things when you think about this, and that the one form is the notice of motion to amend a pre-confirmation plan, and the other one is to modify a post-confirmation plan. So hopefully by that you can clearly see when you're supposed to file each form. The amended one is pre-confirmation, the modified is post-confirmation. There is no longer an option under either one, but it was our current system allowed for an option of limited service if you were not materially adversely affecting creditors. And in our committee discussions, defining what that meant was difficult at best. So you don't get to do that anymore. And this was, as Judge Kelly said with the fees, this was one of the bargains we made because the judges and the trustees wanted all the plans served on all the creditors every time you amend the plan. And that is the new rule. So every time you amend, even if you're only changing the percent from 70% to 100%, you have to serve it on all the creditors. Just keep that in mind when you're going through this.
So let me make one more comment on that. You'll notice in the outline that it says unless the court otherwise directs, and now I'm speaking only for myself. It's at least that I know of. That's not an invitation to file a blizzard of motions requesting shortened notice, basically to try to do by motion what we were doing before the rule change. There will be instances, however, and mostly I have in mind ones that I handle in the courtroom, where a debtor needs to modify the plan, especially to accommodate some secured creditor or something else. And it really only does affect one party. Nothing else is going to change, not even like the amount that the debtor is paying is going to change. I try to remember in those instances to direct that service of the amendment is limited to the affected party and people who get electronic notice. And a lot of times at that point, electronic notice is the only thing that's necessary because the creditors appear to object to confirmation or something. And so the rule carves that out, and the rule would carve out other things, but it's really not an invitation to basically file a blizzard of motion saying I want to limit notice because I'm increasing this to change the percentage going to unsecured creditors in a way that's not material, or I'm just increasing the amount that the debtor needs to pay into the plan. That's the kind of thing that I think one can debate about, depending on how much that increase is, whether or not that's the creditors would want to know about that, because somebody, at least theoretically, could come and say, hey, wait, I don't think the debtor is really going to be able to perform this anymore. And I, at least, probably would not, absent some really good explanation, I wouldn't go for that, and so it's just not an invitation to file a blizzard of motions to limit notice.
The other thing to keep in mind also is if you're filing more than one pre-confirmation amended plan, that subsequent pre-confirmation amended plan needs to restate the terms from any other previous pre-confirmation amended plans. So you can't have three different amendments that all do different things. It's troublesome for the court and the trustees to kind of go back through all of those various amendments and try and figure out all of the different things that have been amended. So the most recent pre-confirmation amended plan needs to state all of the elements that have been proposed to be amended in any other pre-confirmation amended plan.
Yeah, so here's the way that I look at this. There's going to be two things. There's going to be the original, and where there's amendments pre-confirmation. There's going to be the original plan, and there's going to be one amended plan. Because anything that happens in the middle of any amendments that happen between, like, let's assume there was five of them, five amendments, right? There's the original plan, there's five amendments. The only governing documents are going to be the amended plan and, or sorry, the original plan and amended plan number five. Everything in the middle gets superseded. And the reason for that, as was explained, is that it's with some frequency that there are three, five, seven amended plans. Some of those dealt with different things, and then when we get to the time of confirmation, in order to go back and figure out whether or not everybody actually got served, it becomes very difficult to figure out, oh, this amendment affected this, and this amendment affected this, and then this amendment changed the effect of this, and it's really complicated. So now we have two governing documents. All the amendments get served on everybody because you never know what the final operative document is going to be, because the fourth may get superseded by a fifth, which may get superseded by a sixth. So they all the amendments get served on everybody, and the last one becomes operative document, so you only have two, the original and the last amendment.
And that's really important because, you know, one of the examples I gave to my staff as we've been kind of training up for this internally is to really look, we have to look, as a trustee especially, I think, at these interim documents. So you have the original plan, you're keeping a car. You amend the plan to surrender the car. Then you don't repeat that in the third, fourth, and fifth amended plan. I'm going back to that first plan and I am paying the car. So, you know, you have to repeat every time every amendment. So it's something that, you know, we're going to have to look at to make sure that we didn't change something and then it got deleted and it's changing back. And that's important for the creditors too, because if, you know, for X credit union with the car loan, you fix what they wanted, you didn't repeat it, then you're back to the original plan. And that's why you have to, again, going back, serve it every single time.
Right. And if I could just mention on the service, using the matrix is the official mailing list for the case. That's now specified in the local rule, so that there's no doubt about it. And I mean, I don't serve things, obviously, but I understand that it's relatively simple to click on something in CM and print off a copy of the most recent matrix, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so and it comes out in labels.
And, yeah, so if that's the case, it's hard for me to understand why somebody wants to make their own kind of private mailing list that they're gonna attach to a certificate of service. Because what this forces us to do, we want to make sure people are served. We're happy to do things on negative notice as long as it's noticed. So somebody in my office is literally, when you take the matrix that you could easily print off a CM, is my understanding, and put it into a Word document, and it's this list. Now we're going through and going, okay, okay, okay. I mean, this it just seems silly for us and for you. So I would encourage you to please look into using the matrix that you print from CM as an attachment to your certificate of service. And every amended plan, just keep on attaching it. If something changes, it doesn't the matrix get updated? So if a creditor gets added, it's going to be in there. If you use the matrix or your old mailing list that you made from the beginning of the case, that person's not there. Now your plan confirmation is held up because where's this creditor? And we're trying to figure out, was that intentional? Are they still, you know, so again, we raised the no-look fee because we know this is more work for you. We know it's more work for your staff, but if you want your cases confirmed and the thing to move smoothly, doing it this way, we think, will advance that goal.
And I'll say two things about the attachment. When you attach that as a certificate of service, most of you who use this already know in the upper left-hand corner, it gives a date and I think even a time so that I know that you're using the most recent one. And Sean can correct me if I'm wrong, but even as creditors file proofs of claim, that updates the matrix. So if you serve for motor credit at P.O. Box 12345 and they got that, but when they filed the claim, they really want their stuff at P.O. Box 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, then you have, the matrix is going to be updated. You're going to have the most current, correct thing when you mail out your new plan. And I think about this, it doesn't hurt the trustees. It doesn't hurt the judges if this stuff doesn't get served correctly. It hurts your clients, and it could hurt you as far as malpractice if somebody doesn't get noticed correctly. So, you know, as much as folks don't necessarily like this, I think it's for your own good. And if I'm a debtor's attorney, I want to serve everybody I possibly can with all this stuff.
Yeah, nobody, including us on here, wants to deal with, you know, going way down the road and then somebody forced something, saying, hey, this was changed by a plan, and some creditor saying, well, we never got proper notice of that. Either it wasn't served on us or it was served in the wrong place, and nobody wants that.
All right.
Just one quick second. We did make the same modifications to the amended plan events that we made to the Chapter 13 plan event. We've also realigned the names a little bit so it's clear as to which event you should use for a pre-confirmation amended plan versus a post-confirmation modification. So those event titles have been shored up a little bit so you can better find those events.
The other thing, and this really isn't related to the new rules, but there are folks that are fans of as putting this notice in motion to amend or modify the plan and then attaching an original plan document. Please do not do that. That defeats the purpose. The reason we have and we have a whole bunch of white space, we eliminated like the three or four questions where you seem to be answering the same thing the three times. What we want to do is look at only what's changed. It is more work for the trustees and the judges. If you're just filing this notice in motion and you make a statement and then also attach a plan, I got to go through the whole plan. And even if you're only, because I have to compare it to the original to make sure nothing else has changed. So that's just a request. For a while now, I'll just move on in the outline of F Part 3. Post-confirmation modification may include a request for approval of attorney's fees. Most folks know this and have been doing it for a while. So again, it's post-confirmation modification. So before confirmation, you can't add, it was just kind of local practice that folks did. There was no rule attached to it. Now it's in here. But it has been $300 to do a post-confirmation modification without any fee application. So you can still do that, but keep in mind, not pre-confirmation, post-confirmation. The rule 4001, the pre-confirmation adequate protection payments, it's just the substance of that remains the same. Our new plan, when we go over it, has that it has a very similar statement about pre-confirmation adequate protection payments. And the motions for relief from stay, that rule has been renumbered and changed. It does now include requirements that creditors seeking abandonment must comply with service under 6007.
Yeah, I mean, that's the law of the Seventh Circuit, but the national rules are a bit unclear if a creditor is moving, that the creditor, to in order to get abandonment, has to serve on all creditors. And this is true in Chapter 7, too. It gets picked up here in Chapter 13, but that's the general rule, so it has to be served on all creditors to get abandonment.
I know we're not talking about the plan, but it sounds like it's all bad stuff, all this extra work, all this bad stuff. Let me tell you just a teaser, one good thing that's happening. Below median debtors, no more requirement that they give us half their tax refunds if they can fit the anticipated tax refund into their budget. So no more half the tax dismissal because they didn't give us half their tax refunds. If you can budget this debtor for what their anticipated tax refund is, you won't have to give the trustee or the plan the tax refunds anymore.
Yeah.
So that's a plus, I think, for the debtors.
Yeah, and honestly, if to go from one rule to the other, please budget it on the budget and don't provide for refunds in the plan, because what we don't want to do is have change this and then I'm still chasing tax returns refunds because that you put it in your plan. It's going to be difficult for some debtors, and I'm not saying it's an absolute rule that you can never do it, but for most debtors, I think they, you know, if they get a large refund, that means they don't make very much money because they're probably getting an earned income credit and their budgets are really thin anyway. Do a good job on the budget. Ask your clients, you know, you get $8,000 in a tax refund. What do you typically spend that money on? Maybe if they own a house, they use $3,000 of it every year to pay their property taxes. You know, they use that money. We know they use that money. Where you need to be careful and thorough is when you're talking to them about the budgeting process. Okay, if we put a 1/12 of your tax refund on Schedule I, how do we account for that? And we know that, you know, property taxes are only once a year, but make sure they're on the J in the monthly amount too.
Great. So, all right. So you've heard of FEAPS, I think. I'm going to talk about 2014 and 2016. And some of the content stayed the same, a little bit of restructuring, and then some substantive changes. So in 2014A, which is the applications for employment, you have to spell out the anticipated service, that's always been required, and proposed method of compensation. If the application proposes a contingency fee, the application has to state whether the applicant is willing to have the fees reviewed under the reasonableness standard of Section 330, and that was not in the earlier rule. And as Judge Kelly mentioned earlier, the subsections that we had on identifying a fee cap have now gone away. So that's another on your list of good things. That's where we put that one. All right. Sub B of 2014, application must be accompanied by a proposed order. And I think we're going to talk, Sean, about whether that's an event or.
Yeah, we have to figure that out. Normally, when you file a proposed order, you're using the proposed order event. And you're filing on, this is a recent, fairly recent change for our court, where you're not uploading the order through this other system. You're filing it as a proposed order. You file, and the new rule now requires, if you're filing an application to employ counsel or an accountant or something else, you're supposed to file your proposed order right along with your application. If you use the proposed order event, that order is going to get routed to be signed by the judge. And my concern is somebody's going to sign too soon before the objection period has run. So we need to figure out a little bit, and we will let you know whether there'll be a different event or if you just sign, have your proposed order be as an exhibit to your application. I just don't want to be prematurely signing proposed orders.
And so I have a slightly different concern, which is that but the rule requires in part that the proposed order gets served with the motion so that people know what the form of the order is. And so if you use the proposed order event, in my mind, that could work as long as the certificate of service makes clear that the order was also served on everybody. Because my concern, if the motion and whatever the application and the proposed order is all attached as one thing, the certificate of service says all this stuff was served on everybody, that's clear. If you get an application filed and then you get a proposed order and the proposed order event, and the certificate of service doesn't make clear that the proposed order was served on everybody, then I don't know whether or not the thing was properly served.
I would think what you're suggesting is it should be an exhibit to the application.
But if the certificate of service clearly said, I also served this proposed order, which has been submitted at the same time, I could probably live with that. I think the other way is, from my side at least, easier. But I get that if people are like going through ECF and they see something called the proposed order and they have something in front of them that says proposed order, I understand why the inclination would be to use that event, because that's what the event says.
Right. So we'll figure that out. But that's for the trustees, the seven trustees, and the Chapter 11 folks that are filing these applications to employ. We'll figure this out for you so that you know what to do. But No longer should you use that boilerplate that you've been using, that this application is subject to section 328, which provides that blah, 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 blah. On the other hand, if you're filing an application as a trustee to employ a counsel on a contingency basis, that's under section 328, so that's the fee, it's not an hourly rate, it's a contingency, then either say yes or no that the attorney is willing to have his or her compensation reviewed for reasonableness under section 330. If they are, great. If they're not, we'll see. But that's the new requirement that needs to be in these contingency applications. No application needs to say this is subject to 328 and this is the way what that says, which the old rules required.
All right, then we had sections called service of application and objections to application, and now we've just kind of reformatted that a bit under notice and disposition. And so the applicant has to give a 14-day notice of the application to employ. The court could approve a shorter time. The Chapter 13 debtor does not have to get court approval to employ professionals, including real estate brokers. I think, Judge Helfinger, you might have had a decision on that. But we get those applications from time to time, and they're really not required by 327 or 328. So it's just maybe save you a little time and save the court a little time to flag that for you in the rules. And then we move to 2016, which are the applications themselves for compensation. And this does look a little different than what we had. Certainly some requirements remain the same, but we've added some requirements, and that's in part based on looking at what other districts do, as well as just experience with reviewing a lot of applications and trying to meet the requirements of reasonable and necessary, and not getting vague submissions too that you might have to redo if you want to capture those fees. You can see under on your outline E that lists about 8 bullet points of what the applications for compensation have to include. And again, some of those had already been required in our rule as it existed, but some are additional. And
I think one thing that's new, and I would just alert you to, is the description of the experience of a biller who's in, and so some folks use paralegals, or sometimes they use the thing staff. You should put the person's initials and what their experience is. You know, a paralegal with 5 years of experience, or an attorney that graduated in 2002 or whatever. Just in some sort of summary. The experience of the person who is performing the services should be included.
Yeah, and that if you read the Nelson decision, which I wrote probably 8 months ago or so, I mean, I canvassed a lot of districts, and that really is a requirement to help ensure, that the services are required are of benefit. And it shouldn't be too difficult to add that. Although I think probably some office software needs to get tweaked a little bit. I think when we review these fees sometimes, and there are entries that seem to be really vague, but some of these fee apps cover several years, and I realize your billing software, that's how it captured the time. But vagueness of a description, you know, phone call with third party, doesn't really tell me how it helped advance this debtor's case, so you might need to do some tweaking. Let's see. then if there is something in the fee app that the court's going to disallow, it can disallow it without prejudice, without a hearing, if it isn't compliant with what's itemized in the rules. But the applicant can seek a hearing, or certainly could file a new, richer, more detailed application, again, to try to justify those fees. Then 2016.1 is new, and that's putting a description of the no-look fee in the rules. We had kind of floating on the website a description of the no-look fee, and it was fairly general, and I'm sure intentionally so. But again, looking at what other districts have done and trying to capture what should be reasonable, ideally to get at least the debtor to confirmation, we thought a list of what the no-look fee, list of the services ought to be set out. And our list is shorter than some districts. I can at least say that much.
And it actually is in the appendix. So if we, going through the local rules process and getting a rule approved through the district court and the Judicial Council of the Seventh Circuit is time consuming. So we, in the rule, provide for a presumptively reasonable fee, both for cases that make it to confirmation and cases that get dismissed before confirmation. That's what the rule says. And then it refers you to the appendix where the amount of the fee is listed, and then this more the description is there. We are tweaking that a little bit. It will be by November 1st. It will be totally tweaked and should provide you with the information that you need. But just to alert you that if you looked at the local rule, it wouldn't give this information, and that's for a reason, so that in 2 years, if we want to change it and make it higher, we don't have to go through and amend a local rule to make it higher. We just fix the appendix. That's not a big deal.
Is some form of that posted now?
It is. It's just the detail of how do you, and I think, are you going to talk about next, Judge Hannon, the dismissal pre-confirmation?
One change on that, too, before we leave that, is the creditor's presumed reasonable fee has been eliminated. No more.
Yeah, that is in there. I think it was Scott who said it was $4,500, and then $5,000 if there's a triple M motion filed. And then if the case is dismissed before confirmation, the presumed reasonable fee is $1,000.
And I guess
I don't think we had that earlier.
We didn't have that. And just because between ourselves, Scott and I had a question and asked the judges, and I think this is going to be out in the revised form. But what is the $1,000? It's $1,000 net of what you got pre-petition. So if you are charging $4,500 and you got $300 up front, and I have $1,200 on hand, I'm going to give you $700, and I'm going to give the debtor the balance. Okay.
This was put in to try to eliminate if the trustee's holding some money, and the debtor's attorney has done the work to get, and it just the case just is going to tank.
Right.
The debtor's attorney has now been filing a fee application to get that money, and that seemed, and some of these fee applications were for $700 or $300 or some such thing. So to eliminate the requirement to file a fee application where a case is getting dismissed before confirmation, you can now have up to $1,000 from the funds the trustee is holding without filing a fee application. The trustees, and we think this is going to work, this is what still needs to be fixed on that little appendix. The trustee is going to put in his or her motion to dismiss the case pre-confirmation. That the trustee will pay, take notice, that the trustee will pay up to the $1,000, net of anything that was paid pre-petition, to the debtor's attorney before refunding any funds to the debtor, unless an objection is filed or the attorney asks for more money. So if somebody says, I don't think the attorney should get any money for this case, they could file an objection to even up to the $1,000. Conversely, if the attorney says, the trustee's holding $6,000, I did $5,000 worth of work, I'm going to file a fee application, the attorney is able to do that. So if you want more than the $1,000 from what the trustee is holding, you can file a fee application. If somebody objects to you getting up to the $1,000, they can file an objection. All that will be due by the time of the objection period on the motion to dismiss. Make sense? Does that sound workable to the practitioners? I know you wanted more money than the $1,000, but that's what we came up with.
And also, so, keep in mind that when my office is looking to see what amount you collected pre-petition, we're going to be looking at your Rule 2016B disclosure form, or I think it's Form 2030,
yeah.
Or B2030, whatever it is. That form is your official certification of what you received up front. We're not going to be basing it on the plan. As we've discovered, oftentimes the plan sometimes doesn't, there's a typographical error, the plan doesn't really state the accurate amount. So we're basing it on the Form B2030. Because that's your certification as to what you've received up front. And so we're going to look at that form and deduct that from the $1,000.
Yeah,
and it doesn't include the filing fee. If the debtor gave you the filing fee and then you paid the fine, that doesn't count.
Correct.
We are talking fees, right?
Right.
Yep. And the other kind of, to Scott's point, when we get to the new plan form, it doesn't, our current plan has, my fee is this minus this equals this. The new plan form says the balance of fees I am owed is this. So really, you can get it off the Statement of Financial Affairs too,
right.
But you wanted to look at one place and be consistent.
The one place where I'm still sort of in my mind wondering what happens, this, if the trustee is moving to dismiss the case, I think we've got a pretty good procedure now in place to get this. If the debtor is moving to dismiss and the attorney wants this money, I think the debtor's attorney should put in the motion that the debtor has consented to up to $1,000 to be paid from funds that are held by the trustee. And then the trustee should pay that without an issue. Does that make sense?
Make sure you put it in both your motion requesting dismissal and
the order. Right.
The order is really what I'm gonna, and I have a court order. Somebody comes back to me and says, why, you have a debtor that's a little upset, it happens from time to time, why did you pay my lawyer? Because I have a court order telling me to pay your lawyer. So it makes everybody's life easier.
Yeah, so the debtor's motion to dismiss would have language in there saying that seeking the approval of what we'll call the pre-confirmation no-look fee.
Right.
And in that instance, and setting out a 14-day objection period, in that instance, the trustees, I believe, will hold the money until the close of the objection period. And the idea behind all of this sort of rigmarole, if you will, is that in order for the trustees to pay the lawyer rather than the debtor, as probably everybody knows, is the provision in 1326, which says, money has to go back to the debtor after approved administrative expenses. And so this mechanism is designed to get to an approved administrative expense so that the trustees can give that, can pay the debtor's counsel rather than sending the money to the debtor.
Now, do you think we can dismiss the case and you hold the money for the 14 days?
I think so, yeah.
Because I don't want to hold your dismissal, right? If the debtor wants a case dismissed, there's usually a reason for that. And they are entitled to have it dismissed. We shouldn't be holding it up. So I think you could phrase it in your motion to dismiss motion to dismiss with a 14-day objection period from the date of this motion for the payment of the thing, or if they don't want it for some reason.
Yeah, you could, if you have a debtor that...
I just don't want to hold up dismissals.
You know, you can look at the cases, too. I mean, you don't have to, you can decide, oh, there's only $15 in this case.
There's
just
no
don't
money.
Don't put the language in.
Right.
I haven't talked to the judges about this, but to avoid confusion, any case where I do a motion to dismiss on a pro se debtor, I wasn't going to put the language in the motion.
No.
You know, I'm just not, so...
We have a question in Oshkosh.
Sure.
We have a question about notices of conversion.
Conversion?
Instead of just done.
And dismiss.
Well,
it doesn't work on conversion.
It doesn't work on conversion.
But we don't file motions on dismissals.
Yes, you do.
Yes.
You file notices of conversion, but motions to dismiss.
Well, I've been getting them dismissed in a Chapter 13 on a notice of... there's an automatic right to a dismissal.
Right. You're not sending notice out to creditors. It's a...
Correct.
You're filing your... Maybe you call it a notice, but you're filing your motion to dismiss and uploading an order, and there's no time period.
Right. I guess if...
I mean, if one wants... I'm not going to try to argue for how much sense it makes, but the national rules are relatively clear that... The conversion can be done on simply notice, but that the dismissal requires a motion, even though, as Ms. Garcia said, this doesn't need to be served on everybody.
Right. So I think you if you want to get the pre-confirmation no-look fee, and you're moving to dismiss, you want to serve it and give people 14 days. To object to you getting that money if that's what you want. If you don't, if there's no money or you don't want that, you don't have to do that, and then it'll just get dismissed and the trustee will refund what money he or she has to the debtor without paying you. The whole thing was to save you from filing a fee application to get the money the trustee is holding. So. We're not trying to make it harder to get a case dismissed or anything like that. So we've run out of time. Are there any questions in Milwaukee? Thank you for coming in and come to the annual update.
Yeah, come to the annual update. We'll all be around. Post questions to the listserv. We'll certainly answer questions on the listserv if you have them. So, thank you.